Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Trust Company Asset Management Committee conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. If you require any further assistance, please press star zero. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Mr. Ian Bruce. Please go ahead, sir.
Great, thank you, and good morning, everyone. This is April 2nd, and welcome to our public asset management committee meeting. Again, this is Ian Bruce, and I'll just explain who's on the speaker line with me this morning. We have my colleague here in Naples, Timothy Vick. We also have our Sanibel portfolio management team, which includes Craig Holston, Joel Johnson, Gary Dyer, and Ed Siskowski. And also up in Tampa, we have Andrew Vanderhorst with us. And we've also invited a couple of other additional speakers that will chime in towards the end of our call, David Port and Peter Nyes, who head up our trust administration and estate planning team. They're going to give us a quick discussion regarding the importance of some ancillary documents as a part of your estate plan. So more on that later on in the call. But thanks so much for joining us this morning. Just to run over some summary numbers of where we stand here. We are, from a coronavirus standpoint, we're well over 950,000 cases globally. That's as of today. We are continuing to grow at about an 8 to 10% clip per day. That's the current growth rate. And that's down a little bit from last week where we were growing at more of a 10 to 12% growth rate. And again, these are global growth numbers. We have about 215,000 infections here in the United States, growing at about 15% a day here in the U.S., and that's also down from about 20% growth rate this time last week. Other hotspots across the globe include Italy, Spain, Germany, but we're seeing sort of the same trend where the coronavirus continues to grow, but that growth rate has slowed a little bit week over week. So it's somewhat of a marginal positive sign. And then I think of note also, and most people are probably aware of this, yesterday Florida issued the 30-day stay-at-home order, which will take effect at midnight tonight. So I'm sure most of our call-in clients have seen that news, but we thought that was important to at least share. And then from a market, stock market, capital market standpoint, probably the most important news of the day was the jobless claim numbers that came through this morning at 6.6 million, which again is another historic, astounding number. That's on top of the 3.3 million unemployment claims last week. So just in the matter of about 2 weeks, we've had roughly 10 million people in this country file an unemployment claim. What we think that will translate to is probably a pretty quick jump in the unemployment rate. Once that feeds through the data, 10 million jobless claims probably equates to a current unemployment rate of somewhere in that 7 to 8% range. And so that's kind of where we stand right now, and we certainly expect those numbers to grow over the coming weeks. From a corporate standpoint, companies are going to start issuing first quarter numbers here, and what we expect is numbers all across the map, of course, and we've already seen companies kind of eliminate forward guidance for this year, and we'll probably see more of that. So it's going to be pretty difficult to get a handle on what we think companies are going to do over the next, let's call it 12 months. But we're certainly being pretty bearish in terms of our expectations of corporate profits. But we're seeing that trend play out as we speak. In terms of market performance, the S&P 500, which is just a proxy for broader U.S. stocks, is down about 23.5% year-to-date. That's from January 1st through last night. We're about 27% off of the highs that we set on February 19th. And, you know, I also just wanted to share, obviously, there's been quite a bit of volatility in the market, but just in the latter half of March, the market has risen over 10% in the last seven trading days. That includes the decline of yesterday. And then we're up again today. So just in the last seven trading days, the markets have risen about 10%. We don't think that that's particularly important, other than I think it speaks to what we always try and tell our clients, which is the importance of staying the course. I know that none of us sitting here in the middle part of March would have expected markets to rally 10%. In the last 7 days, but they did. And that's the exact sort of short-term trading activity that can occur in a volatile market like this, and it's exactly why we encourage all of our clients to stay the course. If you know what you own and you own good long-term investments, there's no reason to trade around some of these really volatile stock price movements. So with that said, I'm going to continue the discussion. I know Ed Suskowski has some comments on recession, and we're even hearing the word depression being thrown about by various news organizations. So, Ed, if you could just give us some context. I know we already believe we're in a recession or going to experience a recession, but can you just broaden out, give us some context around the difference between recessions and depressions? Thanks.
Sure, Ian, thanks. So two basic definitions, and I'll kind of explain each and then kind of just talk about where we are on a go-forward basis. But a recession is basically two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. A depression, by contrast, is generally defined as a severe recession that's defined as negative GDP growth greater than 10% and lasting more than 3 years. Historically, there have been about five Great Depressions, if you will. There was one in 1640 when the Ming province of China, Stuart monarchy in England, both went bankrupt, basically fighting wars. There was the Great Depression and panic in the U.S. in 1837 due to real estate speculation. There was another depression in the U.K. and the U.S., lasted from 1870 to 1890, very shallow but very long. Generally attributed to the adoption of a gold standard. Then there was the Great Depression here in the U.S. that started here in the U.S., went global, lasted from basically 1929 to the early 1940s, largely a function of massive Wall Street excesses and bankruptcies. Most nations experienced that. And then here recently you have the Greek depression, and that was largely a function of excessive sovereign foreign debt. The characteristics of depressions are massive and sustained increases in unemployment, credit reductions that are massive and sustained, massive decreases that are sustained in output, massive increases in bankruptcies, massive decreases in trade, widespread sovereign defaults on debt, and then sustained volatility in currencies. So some combination or all of those things are attributable to depressions. Just by way of giving you some background, in the Great Depression, the nation's gross national product over that time period shrank by one-third. In 1930, gross domestic product shrank 8.5%. In 31, it shrank 6.5%. In 32, it shrank almost 13%. In 33, it shrank 1.2%. And in 33, it shrank by 3.3%. So that's just huge. Unemployment peaked at about 25% and ran double digits for a full 8 years. Simultaneously, wages declined 42%. And world trade declined 65%. We've had a number of severe recessions in the nation's history, basically since the 1850s through current, you know, call it 170 years. There have been actually 33 recessions, so one about every 5 or 6 years. Following World War II, we actually had pretty good employment, but we had negative GDP in 45 of 1%, down 11.6% in 46, down 1% in 47. It was up 4% in 48 and then down slightly in 49. This basically had to do with the total reallocation of resources and production to actually make things other than bombs and bullets. We had an economic malaise in the early 70s caused by high inflation. In 74, GDP shrank 0.5%. In 75, it shrank by about 0.2%. In the 80s, the Volcker-inspired whip inflation now issue where he raised interest rates massively, caused GDP to shrink 0.2% in 80 and 1.8% in 81. Early 90s, we saw one bad year, largely an inventory correction in 91. GDP shrank 0.1%. In 2001, we did not see a slowdown. We did see a slowdown, but not any negative GDP. And this slowdown was generally a function of poor monetary policy that led to excessive speculation and technology. And then we had the Great Recession in 08 and 09, again, largely attributed to easy monetary policy and massive real estate speculation. GDP shrank in 08 about 0.1, and then 09 it shrank 2.5%. So those are some pretty bad GDP numbers, employment numbers and such for recessions and depressions. It just kind of gives you some compare and contrast. Where we are at this point for 2020 and why we do think this is different is we do think fiscal and monetary authorities have learned lessons from the past. Even Bernanke said in 08-09 that he was not going to allow a Great Depression to happen due to Wall Street. He did not make the mistakes of contracting credit as had happened in the 20s and 30s, and we largely avoided a depression at that time period because of it. Due to this healthcare crisis, we've had a massive and quick fiscal response. Obviously, they're trolling out trillions of dollars, and that probably will get misallocated along the way to some extent, can't help that, but it's been massive, it's been quick, and there will probably be an additional one or two stimulus programs that come through. There's been quick and massive monetary response by the Fed, excellent liquidity in markets to support various fixed income channels. And I think most importantly, what's not terribly well understood is that the banking system in the U.S. at this point is extremely well capitalized. This is in contrast to the European nations who did not recapitalize following the Great Recession. The U.S. did. Our tangible capital levels entering into the downturn in 08-09 ran between 4 and 5%. At this point, the minimum capital levels, tangible capital levels required are 8%, and most banks run between 9 and 10. So they've essentially doubled over the last decade their capital levels, which is really outstanding. We do think that, you know, losses are going to occur, provisions are going to increase, it's going to reduce earnings growth. And, of course, you've seen the reduction in interest rates, which will cause the net interest margins to shrink. But we think that that's largely in the stocks. It's just that the stocks probably won't perform for a while, just given all of these negative headwinds. Where we are generally for 2020 after all of that in terms of expectations, as bad as things are, the Q1 expectation for GDP is that it will shrink approximately 6%. This is on a quarterly basis, not a year. Q2 is expected to be down 25%. Q3 is expected to be up 12%. And Q4 is expected to be up 10%. So that would be down about 3% for the year. And again, that is largely self-induced because just 3 or 4 weeks ago, we just had a roaring economy. This was self-induced, basically a quarantine of business and consumer spending, largely in expectations of helping the nation get through a healthcare crisis. And history will judge whether that was excessive or not excessive enough. And I think the last thing that's important to understand, and Ian touched on this in terms of volatility in stocks, is one of the things that we often look at and that market participants watch is this notion of cash on the sidelines. It's always talked about, and normally it's just jawboning because cash comes in and leaves cash markets to the tune of about $50 to $75 million a week. Billion dollars a week. The week of March 25th, in a panic, you saw $260 billion run into the cash markets. We don't have any more updated information. That's the most recent one, but that is four times the next highest level ever seen since we've been recording cash over the last about 25 years. So that does give you some sense that there truly is a ton of cash out there on the sidelines. And I think we think generally once we get to the other side of this curve and things start to modestly improve incrementally every week, that cash is going to come back into the market. It's unknown how fast, but in 1 week it went from $50 billion to $250 billion. You could see a fairly significant rush back into equities, which are generally at this point as attractive as they've been in 10 years. So that is why we make the consistent comment that you should remain kind of dedicated to your asset allocation, stay the course in the markets. We can't determine when these things are going to happen, but that's where we reside at this point, and that's what's going on. Back to you, Ian.
Yeah, thanks, Ed. That's not only good historical context, but we were touching on this yesterday when we were talking just as a portfolio management group, and I think the general consensus, I'll just speak on behalf of all of us, is that the economic numbers are going to be as scary and as ugly as we've ever seen probably over the next few weeks. But what's unique about this period of time, we also don't see this taking years to play out. Your definition about depression taking 3 years, I don't think anyone thinks that we're in this for a 3 year period of time. So it's somewhat unique. I mean, we've certainly in my lifetime and in most of our lifetimes have never dealt with a situation like this where we're going to get a severe deep contraction in the near term and probably an equally quick upswing on the back end of this. So thanks, Ed, for that. Gary, if you wouldn't mind just commenting again on the bond and the fixed income markets for us. Thanks.
Thanks, Ian. Just quickly, wanted to talk about the fixed income market. And as everyone knows, the Fed has really injected a lot into the financial markets, particularly into the fixed income market with its buying program. And it's really had an effect on several things, including the yield curve. As you may know, back last year, there had been a inverted yield curve a couple of different times, and now it's really steepened. But even given that, we have very low rates. For example, the 2 years down to about 0.25%, and the 10 years up to about 0.75%. But if you look back a year ago, both of those figures were almost 2% higher, but it was a much flatter yield curve at that point in time. So even with that and in this kind of steepening of the yield curve, it's still kind of a dislocated from a sector standpoint. For example, in the financial, energy, and retail sectors, you can see a much more dislocated area where even the shorter term on the yield curve, you can see much higher yields, whereas on the staples and the communication services area, you get much lower yields on those types of sectors. So it's kind of an interesting time in the fixed income market right now because the Fed's doing a lot of buying, but there still are some bargains out there in the fixed income market.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Gary. It's important to understand because so much of capital market movements are dictated by the bond market, not just the stock market. So we want to keep people up to speed on what's going on there as well. So thanks, Gary. Andrew, could you give us a quick update on the energy space?
Absolutely. Good morning, everyone. Kind of keep my comments brief, but this is actually a perfect time to be talking about energy. We have some pretty big market movements today, but let's start from the beginning real quick, just a reminder what's been going on. With the COVID-19 disease going around, everyone calls it coronavirus, we saw an aggregate decline in demand. People are not going to drive as much, trucks are not shipping as much, so forth and so on. So from that perspective, you would expect less demand would start lowering the price. But at the same time, we had two big oil players, Saudi Arabia and Russia, come to a disagreement that has led to a massive increase in production, as well as Saudi Arabia actually cutting their sales price on oil as well. So two very bad things at the same time are pushing down oil prices. And going into the market today, we saw one of the common benchmarks, the Brent crude index, was trading in the low 20s. And, you know, from on the face of it, our thought was this is not going to last forever. We've been through these periods before, most recently back in 15, 16. And at some point, the markets will right themselves because, based on data and history here, we've seen that Saudi Arabia, for instance, needs oil to be higher in value, closer to anywhere from $50 to $80 a barrel based on various benchmarks and base production rates. But they need oil that high to fund their fiscal budget. So from that perspective, we knew this would be probably a shorter-term thing versus a new normal. What we saw today on the news line is the President Trump has spoken with Saudi Arabia, with the Crown Prince there, as well as Putin, and has said, but we have not gotten confirmation of this yet, that they are going to look to cut production by up to 10 million barrels of oil, which would certainly help reduce the oversupply that we're seeing. And based on this, I actually just saw that Brent crude shot up over 33% this morning. It's come back because the market's starting to digest that this is just, at this point, it's still hearsay, right? We haven't gotten confirmation of any cuts. But we would still be cautious on this action. The oil market is going to continue to be volatile because although they might cut production a little bit, the oversupply that they've been creating, we still have the aggregate demand issue. We're going to, not too long from now, we'll be entering one of the higher demand seasons in the U.S., summer driving. Well, at this point, we cannot be certain one way or the other how that will play out if we're going to continue to see stay-at-home, shelter-in-place, or even quarantine orders from our respective governors or from the federal side. So the market is going to continue to be very skittish in the oil market for some time until we start seeing a baseline in the new demand, but is also as soon as Saudi Arabia and Russia come to an agreement on, maybe we should stop playing this game of really trying to grab market share and to punish a lot of U.S. shale companies. And for that part, what we have seen is a number of firms have confirmed that they're starting to shut in production, which means they're closing off how much they're producing because at current oil prices, it's not a good idea to continue to produce it. And from an equity standpoint, we've been slowly watching companies come out and give us their game plans. We will see some volatility in names. We will see some bankruptcies. We saw one yesterday from Whiting Petroleum, a company obviously we have no involvement with, but there are going to be some people that fall by the wayside. On the other hand, some really strong companies such as Chevron have come out and confirmed they're going to reduce their capital expenditures. They're going to hold off on additional stock buybacks to shore up cash and to be able to maintain their dividend. And that's the kind of environment we're going to be looking at for the next possibly 3 months or longer as we work through the COVID-19 crisis as well as the geopolitical disagreement between Russia and Saudi Arabia. It's looking at oil companies and the various sub-industries and understanding their balance sheet, understanding who's strong, who can get through it, versus ones that are more levered and really depend on high oil to survive. So based on that, we've had probably a lot of calls from clients asking, what should we be doing? And we're saying, let's be cautious. It doesn't mean jump in because oil is down. It just means we have to be very careful and very selective in this time because, again, oil jumping 33% in a matter of 5 minutes from from my perspective, a Bloomberg news update just shows you how volatile it's going to be. So we're not out of the woods yet, but we are going to continue to watch it. But the baseline is we do have a very large decrease in aggregate demand based on the coronavirus, and we also have the oversupply. And as those things work themselves out, we will see oil prices normalize, but that's not going to happen overnight. So we are advising to stay cautious. We're not making any knee-jerk reactions, but trying to understand each company and understand their game plan relative to their competitors.